Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Tonight, Thomas Frank and Roberto Di Zerbi go head-to-head in what some might call the data derby. Brentford and Brighton may adopt a similar approach behind the scenes, but how do their sought-after coaches compare? And who is the most likely to fill a managerial vacancy elsewhere this summer? And what are the reasons for the long-running feud between the owners of the two clubs dating back to 2004? I'm Ayoa Kimulere. Welcome to the Athletic FC podcast. Okay, so joining us today, we have the Athletic's tactics writer, Liam Tharm, and also our Brentford writer, Jay Harris as well. Right, let's do this. Let's get into it. There are many similarities between Brighton and Brentford's approaches behind the scenes, which we'll also get into in just a bit. But Jay, a lot stems from a fallout between respective owners, Tony Bloom, Matthew Benham. Tell us a bit more about that.
Long story short, Tony Bloom runs a very successful betting company, and Matthew Benham used to work for him. So Tony Bloom hired Matthew Benham many, many, many years ago. They're very much at the cutting edge of the sports betting industry and basically beating the odds and making a lot of money out of it. And I think it was in 2004 when Matthew Benham leaves the company and he sets up Smart Odds. And there's a lot of similarities between the two companies. But I think the feud comes from the fact that Tony Bloom is, by all accounts, very generous boss, really inspires a lot of loyalty. And he feels like perhaps Benham, not necessarily betrayed feels like quite a strong word, but has taken what Tony Bloom has made and gone, do you know what? I think I can do that. I think I can make a pretty penny out of it. And I think I can be the boss of it. He's gone and done it. He's obviously had huge success as well. And so now I believe they've not spoken to each other for about 20 years. And even just the fact that you've got these two people who used to work at the same company and have then gone on to both own their
two football boyhood clubs in the Premier League.
Incredible story by itself. The feud just adds a little bit of spice to it. Tony Bloom does not go into the director's box when Brighton play Brentford. So when Brighton beat Brentford 1-0 a couple of seasons ago, it was Brentford's first season in the Premier League. It was actually Brentford's first ever loss in the Premier League. There's video footage of Tony Bloom celebrating in the stands. The Brighton fans are chanting his name, and I'm sure the same will happen again tonight. So for two people who run their clubs in a very similar way, they just don't talk to each other. It's strange, but that's where we are.
Yeah, Liam, I'm so fascinated by how it sort of comes to play, this sort of data gathered through gambling and then now into football. How has that data worked its way into football and how the clubs also operate as well?
I think it's not just the numbers themselves. I think a lot of people have this perception almost that they're sort of sat there with these laptops just running simulations for everything the whole time and saying, oh, laptop says keep the manager, sack the manager. I can speak sort of more on Bloom than Benham, but I know him to be, from people that I've spoken to, a really good human in how he interacts with people, the relationships that he's formed. And I think using data in an open-minded way and the principles from it. So the idea of being able to sort of look at performance holistically and sort of on a sustainable manner of saying, look, we're not just primarily going to care about the goals or the results, but in terms of the trajectory of the club, the way it's going through. You look at the people that he's hired in terms of the coaches. So Graham Potter, that's then gone on to bigger things at Chelsea. Dan Ashworth is someone that's come in as well. So someone that clearly knows how to form connections with people and quite quickly and in quite a fast changing environment. And Paul Barber is someone who's worked very closely with Tony Bloom, and they've sort of spoken of that open-mindedness of getting that where Brighton are on sort of the food chain, and that people are going to move on and they're kind of at peace with that. Obviously, they're not happy about it. Mm-hmm. There's the benefit of getting money for it, but yeah, they're quite accepting the fact that it's a sign of success. And I think it's part of the broader picture in terms of, yeah, their sort of use and application of data, but they're also clearly really smart humans as well.
Football's a narrow-minded industry, right? For so many years, and even now to this day, a lot of people say, well, you can't be an elite-level manager unless you're an elite-level player. Mm. And obviously, there are examples out there that prove that that's completely wrong. And I think the advantage that Benham and Bloom had is that they didn't have that baggage of having worked in the football industry. They'd worked in the business industry, and first and foremost, football clubs are a business. And so I think the way that they approached running those clubs was just done in a very unique way. You know, Liam and I were talking on a different podcast last week about Matthew Benham's approach to bringing in set-piece coaches and ball-striking coaches and all these different specialists, where I'm sure if you went into other Championship or League One clubs a few years ago and had said, oh, why don't you hire a set-piece coach, you would have been laughed out of the building. So I think it's that open-mindedness to try different things. And again, like Liam alluded to, lots of people think Brentford have this massive database of players, which is true. I think their database contains about 80,000 players around the world, which is just ridiculous. How do you monitor that amount? But they'll have the correct filters and they'll have dedicated scouting teams that do that. But actually, the main way they use data is just on day-to-day decisions to do with the squad. So Rasmus Ankersen, who's now kind of like chief executive at Southampton, used to be Brentford's co-director, and he's done a TED talk, and he does this TED talk about how that famous phrase, the table never lies. And he basically said the table always lies. There are so many different and random factors in the world of football. It's a low scoring sport. And so Brentford will always look at the underlying metrics. These guys were talking about XG before we knew what XG was. So those are the kind of things they look at.
A great specific example of that on a Brighton level is Pascal Gross, who was their first ever Premier League signing in the summer of 2017. Came from relegated Ingolstadt in the Bundesliga. Someone that for a lot of people watching football probably wouldn't come across or would see and just sort of gloss over. But he came out, his assist numbers weren't phenomenal, but his chance created numbers were really, really good and sort of disproportionately good for a relegated team. And that was, I believe, the type of player that got firstly sort of flagged by data, and then Pascal Gross has sort of spoken on this since, that Brighton compiled this massive dossier, and okay, this isn't Bloom necessarily doing it himself, but the team of people he employs of how he plays, his tendencies, his personal life. He was like, there's things in there about me that I didn't even realise were about me. So it shows the, you know, the data is probably sort of the start point and the end point. And I know Brentford sort of say similar stuff to that. And then there's all the stuff in the middle. It's like almost like a sandwich, if you will.
Yeah, I've heard from multiple, you know, contacts within the industry that Brentford's presentations when they want to sign a player are out of this world because of the detail they're going into, talking about why they want a player to play in this particular position, how it's going to work, their interactions with other players in the team. So Brentford just broke their club record signing Igor Thiago from Club Bruges. So it was announced a couple of weeks after the January transfer window. I think off the top of my head, the number is about 33 million euros. And Igor Thiago has had a good season for Club Bruges in Belgium, but he's only been there for 8-9 months. This time a year ago, he was playing in the Hungarian top flight. So in the space of a year, he's gone from the Hungarian top flight to 33 million euros. That's a lot of money, right?
That's a lot of money.
You might raise your eyebrows and think, okay, he scored some goals in European competition this season, but that's still a lot. Brentford have been monitoring since he was playing in Brazil for Cruzeiro when he was about 18, 19. And 4 or 5 years later, that's turned into a club record signing. So Brighton and Brentford are not teams who just see, oh, this player's playing particularly well, we'll keep an eye on him. They've been scouting these players for years and years and years, following the trajectory. And then when the time's right, they pounce.
Which then has me wondering, based on the fact that they've got this database, both teams have a whole of a heap of players they've been monitoring for so long. Have they ever crossed swords on players or on transfers for that reason?
Definitely in terms of the type of saying we're going to ease towards sort of younger players that we can either flip for a fee or we can develop over a period of time, and being prepared to shop in sort of wider European markets that are outside of the top five leagues.
So I know that Karen Matoma, lots of people think Brentford and Brighton looked him. That's not strictly true. I think Midtjylland, who used to be Brentford's sister club, it's not the case anymore. I think Midtjylland were looking at Matoma, but Matoma goes to Brighton. Then he's sent on loan to Union Saint Gilloise.
And then
he becomes the phenomenal winger that he is. But certainly he's a player that there was a lot of crossover between Brentford and Midtjylland. So he was certainly on their radar and was someone that they looked at.
Isn't it fascinating, though, Liam, how this sort of data-driven kind of approach, and we talk about them being, you know, pioneers in it to a certain degree, has now sort of started spreading towards the Premier League. I think about Chelsea, but in a weird way, they're kind of using it in a whole different way. They're not buying cheap, they're buying expensive. Yeah, yeah. You know, one size doesn't fit all, but you have to have it perfect. You have to have it really finely tuned to know what you're doing.
Yeah, there's two sides of it, I'd say. The first is that it builds into sort of Brighton's a club more broadly. There's something they speak about in the academy there that, and their academy's been really good, and we'll probably touch on this later in sort of terms of signings and obviously operating differently to Brentford. But in terms of players you can recruit at academy level, it's up to a 90-minute drive away and sort of a radius from where your training ground is. Obviously for Brighton, same with Southampton, Bournemouth, any South Coast club, half your catchment area is in the sea. So they're like, in terms of the players we can recruit and bring in, we've got to either have a really good pathway, which they do now, so they can get in those players. Obviously Southampton have had a historically successful academy as well, which would give players more reason to go. But they're saying they've not quite got the reach that some of the London-based clubs will do, some of the Northern-based clubs. So even sort of then down from the younger age groups, how they'll look at bringing players in or being more open-minded and saying, look, we can either sort of say, well, it's me, the cards are sort of dealt against us in this situation, or we can try and find these alternative ways of just not closing ourselves off to things. I think it's the case where Brighton aren't suddenly aware of players that, or Brentford aren't suddenly aware of players that no one else are looking at, because it's so easy now. You can go on YScout, you can get publicly available data. Clubs can easily get good players flagged. But they're prepared to, I think, buy players a move or two moves earlier even than what other clubs are doing. They'll look at a player in Paraguay in first division, if we take Julio Enciso, and they might say, yeah, he looks really good, but we need to see him make a step up first. And actually, can he sustain that level of performance, that level of fitness, adapt to the culture, however you want to look at it, all those parts of the game? Can they do that in a fifth, sixth, seventh tier in Europe? The overall ranking's not like a fifth division. And then we might look to buy them, but they'll say, no, look, we can bring them in now and we'll develop them more in-house. And other clubs, fairly and rightly so, you might look at a big six club and say, they don't need to do that because they've got the finances to say, we can let them go somewhere else and then buy them for 30 or 40 million pounds. So it's just sort of knowing where they can compete.
I think it's also important to note that Tony Bloom and Matthew Benham are using their own data. So that gives them a little bit of an edge. Often when other teams use data resources, it's a shared resource. So there's less of a marginal gain there if you're sharing that information with others. And also, Brighton and Brentford had never been in the Premier League before and not in the old First Division since the 80s and 40s respectively. So the fan base was more open to them taking risks and making slightly strange decisions. And some of the best examples are Brentford got into the playoff semi-final, their first season in the Championship under Mark Warburton, but then he left. And there was very much a difference in how Mark Warburton wanted to sign players and how the club wanted to sign players. And then obviously Brentford brought in the B team as well. And they got a lot of criticism for bringing in the B team and scrapping the academy. They got a lot of criticism for parting ways with Mark Warburton after he just got them into fifth in the Championship. But I think their model with the data and some of the players they've signed and developed and the money they've made from those players, Ollie Watkins is obviously the best example, and Saïd Benrahma, kind of proves that they were right to take those decisions. And it'd be very easy at other clubs for them to get distracted by the noise and upset by the noise and kind of row back on some of the things they've done. And also Brentford admit that they have made mistakes along the way. After Warburton left, they appointed someone called Marinus Dijkhuizen, and I think he lasted 10 games before they sacked him. So everybody has this idea of Brentford are so clever, Brighton are so clever. Both teams have made mistakes along the way. It's just that they've not been terminal. And they've also self-reflected and say, okay, do you know what? That hasn't worked. Let's just change that as quickly as possible and we'll learn. Let's not change too many things at once. And I think that's been key as well.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You're listening to The Athletic FC podcast with Ayo Akinwalere.
But let's move to the managers, and I'm quite fascinated by this sort of data-driven approach. You know, have we now, based on this data, got two managers that have very similar philosophies at their particular clubs? And I'd like to sort of see if there's actually some synergy there based on how the club has scouted him. For De Zerbi, for instance, you know, is it more that he's at the right destination, or is it more that his philosophy drives his team to do what they did last season in particular?
The best way I can describe, if you, and I think it's relevant to compare him to Graham Potter as his predecessor, is De Zerbi has massively raised the ceiling in terms of Brighton were obviously often beaten with the stick of can't score enough goals. You know, there's certain Twitter accounts that have made a following off of tweeting out Brighton's goals and their XG sort of on a game-by-game basis under Graham Potter. And under De Zerbi, quite quickly, he got the team scoring, he got players scoring, and someone like Solly March, who historically had scored some really good goals, but wasn't sort of as, you know, a scorer of great goals, not a great goal scorer, which wasn't the case under Potter. And at the same time, the defence has kind of dropped out a bit. They now are occasionally going somewhere and getting smashed or conceding a lot of goals. It is a really big net positive. They're, you know, they've broken club records for points, for the finish position, got a first European season out of it and done really, really well overall. I think he's and Jay can speak better on Frank than I can, but I think De Zerbi's a lot more dogmatic. He's spoken numerous times sort of saying that he can't play or doesn't want to play any other way than this very intricate, you know, through the middle, baiting the press on, trying to find these patterns to play through. There's a great video where he sort of breaks it down with Glenn Murray of saying that, you know, when this defender's got the ball here, if he gets pressed this way, he should play one of these two passes. I also remember similar to that when I think Brighton beat Manchester United at the Amex late last season. I think it was that game. Lewis Dunk spoke to Jamie Redknapp afterwards on Sky, and they were showing some passes and Dunk was breaking it down, and Jamie said, oh, what a great pass here. And he goes, actually, that's the wrong pass. I've been pressed this way, so it should be a different one, which again, at its best, means you carve through teams in two or three passes. And look, they've been the best two teams against the big six since Brentford came into the Premier League. So their styles are different, but working. So I think De Zerbi being so dogmatic works when it works really, really well. And when it doesn't come off, he's had some fair critique, I think, about sort of being adaptable or having a plan B.
Yeah, one thing that stands out for both teams is just how industrious they are, though. I mean, you know, is that by design or by style of manager?
I think you have to be. Mm. I remember there was a game where it was the opening day of the 2022-23 season, and Brentford came back from 2-0 down against Leicester City to draw 2-2. And Thomas Frank doesn't often get rattled or irritated in press conferences. Somebody said to him, felt like your players didn't put in much effort in the first half. I just suddenly saw his eyebrows raise. And he said, if my players didn't put in effort, we wouldn't be in the Premier League. Because of the quality of players and the quality of their opponents, Brighton and Brentford have to work harder than the teams they're coming up against. I think, firstly, Brentford's philosophy is Matthew Benham's philosophy. Brentford play the way that he wants to play. That's his overarching vision. And I think it's obviously Thomas Frank's responsibility to implement it. But because Thomas Frank's been there, I think he's been head coach for 5.5 years now. I think it was October 2018 he was appointed. Everybody just assumes it's his way of playing. But I do think that Frank is very adaptable. Brentford were great entertainers in the Championship. I think some people forget that. For two seasons consecutively, they were a joy to watch. When they had Watkins and Bumo Benrahma as that fluid front three changing positions, they were great fun. And then you sign Ivan Toney and you have to play in a different way, and Ivan Toney gets you promoted. You can't play the same way in the Championship that you do in the Premier League. Burnley are the living embodiment of that. And so Brentford go more direct. They go longer. They've always been a good set piece team, but they rely even more on set pieces. But then I think what Brentford hoped to do this season was kind of slowly morph back into what they were in the Championship. They'd had two seasons in the Premier League. They wanted to be more ball dominant, but just the amount of injuries they've had this season's completely wrecked that. But I think Thomas Frank's biggest strength is that he can just adjust to negate the opponent's tactics.
I wonder if the Zerbi gets, I feel like where people tend to rank them, and not massively in the interest of sort of ranking managers, I think it's quite hard to do, but he's probably got a little bit more appeal, I think, sort of generally than Frank.
Is that because of that dogmatic nature you're talking about? He has a sense of like, partly, this is what I'm bringing partly to the club. Whereas Frank, as you said, it's more of a company thing, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's also a fact that he gets the kind of praise that I think fans buy into too much. So Guardiola, I think he came out and said he's one of the best coaches, most influential, Arteta, because De Zerbi is playing in a way that is how those coaches want their teams to play. That's what they believe is, for better or for worse, the right way to play. I think one of the biggest compliments actually that Pep gives out, and he sort of said this with Klopp, is Klopp, you know, leaving Liverpool is going to give him fewer sleepless nights, that it's, you know, it's making things better for him. He hates playing Brentford. You should see any of Guardiola's press conferences before or after Brentford. I was at the City game when Brentford lost. Phil Foden scored a hat-trick and City won 3-1 from Brentford being 1-0 up. And after the game, someone asked, the first question in the press conference to Guardiola was, talk to me about Phil Foden. I think it was his first senior hat-trick. They were like, amazing moment for him, having a phenomenal season. And he went, Brentford are so hard to play against. Like, the spaces are so small. They're so compact. And it's just a case of, and again, I don't want to divulge too much into Guardiola on a pod that's not about him, but he's the sort of guy that praises teams that play against him in the way he wants his teams to be played against. So he wants someone to press them so they can play through. He wants teams to attack so they have space to play into. Doesn't want to play a low block the whole time. Obviously, Brentford last season did the double over City, the only team to do so in the league, and I think one of five or six teams in, you know, Guardiola's history there. Brighton have similarly been good against sort of big sides. They've also had games where they've struggled because it's just not come off at all. So there's probably a clearer end game towards what De Zerbi is trying to do of saying playing this sort of set. It's a bit more structured and a little bit more rigid. And I think there's value to doing things both ways. But I think the adaptability point's really important with Frank. He doesn't get enough praise for of, you know, having a way of saying, we're going to switch shape. And I know he's gone to Monday Night Football and sort of broken all this down of changing shape, sort of changing approach against sort of the big six teams, the high possession teams, and going to a more 4-3-3, more attack-minded sort of against teams where, yeah, they can dominate the ball.
Recruitment's something that's really fascinating in football, just for results alone. You know, players, of course, are important, but also let's talk about the respective backroom staff, you know. We talked about, I think it was this week, it's been revealed that Bernardo Cueva, Brentford's set-piece coach, is off to, what, Chelsea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then how many people have Chelsea pitched from Brighton? I mean, just how much
have you got?
Yeah, exactly. Just how much attention is paid on the structure of those people in the backroom for Brentford, for Brighton?
Yeah, like I said earlier, Brentford are just open-minded. And they've were kind of the ones who kickstarted this trend of having set-piece coaches. And again, it's something Liam and I spoke about on the Tactics podcast last week. It's an area of the game that had been overlooked before. And I think the first set-piece coach at Brentford was Gianni Vio, who then went on to help Italy win the Euros, and he was part of Antonio Conte's backroom staff. He's replaced by Nicolas Jova, who goes on to Man City and is now at Arsenal. Then Brentford had Andreas Gordon, who again went to Arsenal and then I think became Malmo sporting director. And now they've got Bernardo Cueva, who's off to, I think, lead Chelsea's set piece department. It's all about having people that can bring different perspectives. Everybody knows, well, most people know of Thomas Gronemar, the the world's only throw-in coach or the world's only full-time throw-in coach. He made a big difference to Liverpool winning the title. Well, he worked with Midtjylland and then worked with Brentford a couple of years before he worked with Liverpool. So like I said earlier, it's about these clubs being open-minded and trying to do different things. And really it stems from Brentford had one of the lowest budgets when they were in the Championship, and they've still got one of the lowest budgets now in the Premier League. So how do you improve the quality of your squad if you can't just go out and spend 20, 30 million pounds on a player? You get these specialists who hopefully improve tiny little things, which it's hard to measure the direct impact they have, but will have a tiny impact, even if it's on a player's confidence to take a shot from 30 yards and put it in the top corner the next time it happens. So again, when you're a club of the size of Brighton and Brentford, you can pay a little bit more attention to those things, because obviously Brentford are in a really bad run of form at the moment, but it's not the end of the world. If Chelsea were on that bad run of form, it's the end of the world, mm-hmm. and everything becomes very short-termist, whereas Brighton and Brentford can always kind of have that medium to long-term view of what's going to make us better over an extended period of time.
You know, what Jay said there is really interesting in terms of the profiles of the clubs, meaning they're able to take more gambles, but also how much of these gambles and how much of this data in general is also about sustainability within the Premier League. And I remember, I think I was talking to someone from Brentford, Rasmus Ankersen, before he left, when they first came to the Premier League, and he was like, we've got all this work that we're doing, but we're very realistic. You know, we might also be leaving next season, and we're prepared for that. Mm. I mean, how far in advance are they prepared for the possibilities of potentially leaving the Premier League?
Well, I mean, from the way that Brighton acted when Graham Potter left for Chelsea, they always have succession plans in place. Mm. There's a lot of internal promotion across all the sides of academy, women's side, men's side, of people moving up roles, and not just a case of like earning those promotions, but saying we understand the value of having someone that's been at the club for a period of time that already understands the culture and where the club is at. There's been very clear ambitions which are literally posted up on the walls in the club at the training ground of being a top 10 Premier League team on the men's side. I think it's either a top three or top four WSL side, of having X number of minutes or percentage of minutes played by academy players. So it's not heads need to roll if these things aren't necessarily met, but it's saying here's what we want to be and become, and then that is so much easier to implement when you've got that vision very clearly, that then makes things very actionable on a day-to-day basis when you know what you're working towards.
Yeah. I think with Brentford, it's something Thomas Frank has spoken about. They're very aware of the fact that they might get relegated. They've always maintained that outside of the top six, and you can probably put Aston Villa and Newcastle in that category at the moment, maybe Brighton, maybe not, all the other 11, 12 teams in the Premier League are at risk of going down. This time a year ago, Brentford were, I think, in the middle of a 12-match unbeaten run, or just gone on a 12-match unbeaten run, and finished, I think, 2 points off the Europa League. And now they're 5 points above the relegation zone, and quite fortunate, maybe fortunate is the wrong word, would be lower down in the table if Nottingham Forest and Everton hadn't picked up points deductions. Things can change like that. And they were really confident at the beginning of the season that they'd potentially finish in the top half of the table again. All that matters now is avoiding relegation. All it takes is for a few injuries to the wrong players, for a transfer sale that you weren't expecting to happen, and the dynamics completely change. You know, you do have to give a lot, you know, Brighton have been a bit inconsistent this season, but they've been in the Europa League for the first, well, European competition for the first time in their history.
And they're still top 10, aren't they?
They sold McAllister and Caicedo. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How many other teams in the Premier League, if they sold their two best individuals, would be able to maintain that level of performance? And it's inevitable at some point that Brighton will have a bad season where too many players, or the manager leaves and there's not an immediate uptick in form. It will happen. But I think sometimes it's like anything in life. If you worry about the bad things too much, it almost becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. You almost have to accept the fact Brighton and Brentford are still punching above their weight. Things might go wrong, but as long as you do everything you can to kind of prevent that from happening, then hopefully you should be all right.
When we talk about both managers, I mean, it's fair to say they're both pretty strong characters. If they do inevitably end up moving on from their respective teams, how can we break them down in terms of who they're more likened to?
Yeah, I've spoken to a few players and former players about Thomas Frank, and they all say he's like a friend. I think it was Romain Sawyers, who was, you know, Brentford's captain for a spell under Thomas Frank, who said he's a manager you can have a coffee with. I definitely think Thomas Frank's emotional intelligence is probably one of his strongest assets. Mm. So for example, I don't know if everybody can remember, but there was a game over Christmas where Nathan Collins is playing against Wolves, his former club, and he makes two errors that lead directly to a goal where he basically passes without looking and Wolves score. And Thomas Frank said afterwards, there was no real point me saying anything to Nathan in the dressing room after the game. He was too devastated. But what I did do was ring him on the way home and chatted for 10, 15 minutes just to say, don't worry, you're a great player. And I think that was probably the smartest thing he could have done to just boost Collins' confidence, right? There's been many other examples where I think he's obviously would have had a few conversations with Ivan Toney while Ivan Toney was out banned. I think in public, he's been very supportive of Toney. He's never really criticised him for what has happened. He's just said, you know, he's a player. We'll support him whichever way we can. As I mentioned earlier, Brentford are in a difficult run of form, but I think something that stood out to me is when Vissa scored against Chelsea, Vissa ran over and celebrated in front of the dugout, and then all the players kind of jumped on Thomas Frank, and I thought, okay, that's a real sign of unity and togetherness. So I think wherever he goes in the future, he'll quickly get the players in the dressing room on board.
I think De Zerbi shares Guardiola's sort of perfectionism and is similarly animated on the touchline. Someone who tends to gesticulate a lot. He's got booked an awful lot this season, or I think he might be the most booked manager in the league. So he's had his fair sort of share of things to say about refs. And there's part of that where I think there's been times where he's perhaps not tolerated certain players. I know that with Leandro Trossard leaving and Robert Sanchez leaving, that sounded like, from what the reports look like, a breakdown really in sort of a player wanting a certain thing or things their way, and Zobi saying, no, it's going to be done how I want it to be done. If you don't like that, you can leave. Which obviously, again, has its pros and cons of you can get a team to work in real unity, but you might not be able to fit in sort of, I don't want to say maverick's the wrong word, but players that might want a bit more give on their end. So it would then be interesting to see him at a bigger club or a club with bigger expectations and sort of demands, because Brighton have been a bit inconsistent at times in terms of results this season, and that is due to sort of a variety of things. Been a few sort of 1-1 draws at home against bottom half teams where Brighton have either gone 1-0 up and then, you know, dropped points or not put the game to bed, or they've gone 1-0 down to a poor goal, a set piece goal, and salvaged a late equaliser but not really looked that good. And De Zerbi, really the thing he's bemoaned the most is sort of the injuries and not having sort of the depth. That's the one, I think, area of disconnect between sort of him and the club has been he wanted more recruitment in January. There are injuries that sort of came out of nowhere or you just didn't expect to happen, or the amount when they came. But Bloom and the rest of the staff felt that they were in a good enough place with the players they had and the depth that they had. Again, not to say that either person was right or wrong. I don't think Roberto De Zerbi is going, I told you so, but just from a coaching perspective, wants to have that depth to really compete Premier League, in the Cups, in Europa League.
Yeah, I guess, you know, like, no coincidence he's been, you know, connected with certain big jobs, Bayern Munich, for instance, and whatnot. You know, writer, Andy Naylor for The Athletic basically said that De Zerbi's concerns is whether he will have the equipment to match his ambition of ensuring the club record high finish of 6th last season does not turn out to be just a one-off. Now, we've reported that, you know, Brighton made serious profits, you know, based on what he's done, but also based on what the club has done. Is there an idea that, let's say, him, the chairman, see eye to eye, a few, you know, new recruits are brought in, they spend some serious money, that, you know, that could twist his answers to curb those ambitions for a bigger club?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's also worth noting that Tony Bloom, as a fan of the club, invests a lot of his own wealth into the club. So it's slightly different in the sense that this isn't, it's obviously technically external investment, but it's not a company that are just pouring, you know, however many millions into it. It's someone that's got a real sort of passion. So there's probably a degree of care on that regard. And look, you know, Bloom and Paul Barber especially have been the consistence throughout that whole time. You're looking back to when sort of the Amex opened in 2011, from just promoted out of League One throughout the whole championship journey to the Premier League. So I don't think they've ever necessarily been sort of conservative with chances, but they've never, there was probably a period, I think 2018-19, where they made quite a few attacking signings. I think Jurgen Locale, Ali Reza, Jahan Bash come to mind of players they spent big money on at the time and didn't come off because it was Chris Hughton in a more defensive team. But since then they've not really spent ridiculously. That sort of showed in January. I think they were interested in Kieran Dewsbury-Hall and there's a really important point to make here is that Tony Bloom, as well as sort of his data background, as his business, is a professional gambler, plays poker professionally. And it sort of shows every transfer window where big clubs come looking for Brighton's players or staff and you go, good luck, you're going up against someone who plays poker for a living and knows how to bluff and makes millions doing it. Good luck trying to get a player out of him for anything less than what he thinks is right. So you look at the fees for Benjamin White, Mark Cucurella, maybe not even Bissouma, but you know, Moises Caicedo, Alexis Mac Allister, that people consistently say, oh, you're paying Brighton too much for these players. Well, you keep doing it, they're going to keep accepting the fees. Reason being is because they've got someone that, yeah, has succession planned and knows how to negotiate on the human side.
What about Thomas Frank, Jay, in that respect? What, Brentford, 5 points clear of relegation. I mean, things can still swing. We're surprised that De Zerbi's getting all this Bayern Munich conversation, you know, wherever, Liverpool conversation, and yet no conversation really about Thomas Frank's departure, or is it in danger?
I think there was a lot of talk last season. I don't think he came close to getting the Aston Villa job ahead of Unai Emery, but there were definitely discussions. He was also linked with Leicester City, but I think the money involved in sacking Brendan Rodgers made them delay their decision. It's hard to know what's going to happen with Thomas Frank because he's always kind of linked to, I've seen him mentioned with the Liverpool job, for example, but he's always at the bottom of that list. For some reason, feels like he's always the bridesmaid, never the bride when these kind of conversations come up. And I think that he's shown over his 5 years at Brentford that he deserves a shot at a club that's maybe challenging in the top six, top eight of the Premier League. But what he's always been very clear on is that he just wants a club with a vision and a club with a project. And, you know, I had a Brentford fan talking to me the other day about, oh, I could see him at West Ham, but I don't know if he'd see that as necessarily a step up. Thomas Frank's created history at Brentford. When he leaves, there'll probably be a statue made of him, right? He got them promoted back into the Premier League for the first time in 74 years. He kept them in the Premier League for two seasons, hopefully three. He's recorded victories over Arsenal, Man City, Tottenham, Liverpool. Big stuff, right? And yes, this season's been a bit of a backward step because of injuries, but he'll probably be thinking, I'd love to take this club into Europe, and look, his legacy's already cemented and confirmed, but to take it that next step on, he could sacrifice what he's got at Brentford for another traditionally bigger team, shall we say, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he'll A, get the time that he deserves, and B, have as much of an impact. So I think the only kind of teams in England that he'd potentially leave for are the ones who are kind of competing to qualify for the Champions League and for the titles. But for some reason, I get the feeling that those opportunities would never come up. I certainly felt like Tottenham last season might have been the one where they could have gone for him, but obviously they went down a different route. So it's strange because, yeah, last season there was a lot of talk about him and it's all just completely died this year. So it feels like his future for the time being is very much at Brentford. And differently to Brighton, I don't think Brentford really succession plan like that. Obviously, partially that's because Thomas Frank's been there for 5 years or nearly eight, if you include his time as an assistant coach. But also, there are so many different variables, so many things change all the time. They're just happy kind of continuing as they are for now.
Okay, well, before we wrap, I just want to give you a quick plug, Jay, because if you want even more insight into how Brentford, the bees, are run behind the scenes, you can listen to the Athletic's Go Deeper series, Access All Areas Brentford. Jay was behind that. Liam, Jay, thanks for your time. And also don't forget to rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to the Athletic FC podcast. The producers were Guy Clark, Mike Stavrou and Jay Beale. The executive producer was Amy Moorhead. To listen to other great Athletic podcasts for free, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places. The Athletic FC podcast is an Athletic Media Company production.
The Athletic.